managed colonies of Hawaii honeybees are coming back from the destruction of the varroa mite. A decade ago, the blood-sucking pest threatened Hawaii's bees. In response, the UH Honeybee Project was founded to help beekeepers cope. Greater populations of bees are now opportune as growth, as grown in Hawaii produce gets more attention with Governor Ige's push to double Hawaii food production by 2020. Ethel Villalobos is head of the UH Honeybee Project and was out giving bee demonstrations this past weekend and traveling quite a bit. She's with us now. Good to have you. Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
Just as a reminder, if I were a bee, what would it be for me to have a varroa mite on me?
It would be pretty horrible. Imagine a tick the size of a big salad plate attached to your back or to your stomach. Plus, the tick will have some nasty diseases, some viruses that will make you even feel even worse.
This is, you know, pretty detrimental to not only just particular bees, but as a whole, what we were seeing in the population. But it seems as if there are ways of coping with varroa, largely that have come through your organization, that have been helping farmers and helping other beekeepers. What specifically has made the difference?
A lot of things, including participation of the beekeepers, are work in collaboration with developing of new treatments. There was a Canadian company that was very interested in testing it in Hawaii. So we participated in that trial. The chemical's an organic chemical. So we were able to steer the beekeepers to follow organic practices rather than adding more pesticides to the already stressed out bees. And I think that has proven very successful.
Can you give us an example of how that happened with some of the farmers and what they've been able to do and how they're able to build this? I mean, it's not just the idea if you have a box and in go the bees. There were more issues to it than that.
No, there were. And the original style of beekeeping, because we had so few pests and the bees were so healthy, was simply keep a big box, the bees will make honey, you'll go and get honey when you need honey. So it was a very simple affair. So it took a while of kind of realigning people's heads in terms of you need to actually check them. They're sick. You need to provide treatment. You need to make sure that they have enough food. You need to plant things that they like. And through time, especially the farmers, saw the advantage of even changing their own agricultural practices and switching to different kinds of weeding, using less herbicides, using less pesticides, because they really value the contribution of the bees. So it was a pretty holistic change at the level of the farm and beekeepers and farmers. And it really did have a profound impact, and is having a profound impact that you can tell even in the public, in the general public.
I was just going to ask you, and what about the rest of us who aren't having to do this and keeping, you know, a bee that is also helping with a family farm?
A lot more interest in bees, a lot more interest in what can I do at home, what can I plant, what can I do to help beekeepers or to help bees? And our answer is usually very simple. You know, buy local food, buy local honey, support the beekeepers, support the people that produce in a very sustainable fashion, go to the small markets, and really support agriculture at the local level.
The supporting of local agriculture is a message we've heard for a long time, but do people understand what would happen in the absence of the bees, or what kind of produce might be available were there not bees to pollinate?
We're working on it. And yes, they do, but not 100%. Just recently, this past Saturday, we had an event at the Urban Garden Center, and people were asked to fill a quick survey. And what we're trying to gauge is the understanding of the public. So, for example, you know, do people have basil? Yes, they do. Do they know that basil is good for bees? Yes, they do. But people also think tomatoes are bee pollinated, which usually they're not. So we're trying to build that distinction and gain information from them to in a sense, turn around and find ways to communicate which is the right and the wrong answer, and help them encourage the flowers that, you know, might be, or the vegetables that they might grow in their backyard that are actually bee friendly. Something like sweet potato, they seem to not know that it was bee friendly.
This seems to be pointing to a deeper issue, that we've lost a lot of this knowledge that used to be passed from, you know, one generation to the next to be able to keep not only a beautiful garden, but to be able to have the kinds of plants that we could eat and enjoy, and that the bees would also be responsible for pollinating. This seems to have gone away with all of our industrialized food production. Are we getting back to more of this now, particularly the fact that we are here in this islands, in these islands?
I am hopeful. When you see the number of people that showed up, for example, at this plant sale, that it was a bee-friendly plant sale. When you see teachers that call us to give presentations at the school because they're developing a school garden, I am hopeful. I think a lot of work needs to be done, but I think there's a bright future ahead.
Because we now have 10 years behind us of dealing with the varroa mite. Has Hawaii become sort of a learning lab for other places? Are you called by other places to say, hey, what can you do to help us?
Yes, we are, because we're like one of the most tropical states for the United States. We recently were asked to go help Dominican Republic and Haiti. And we went, myself and a grad student, went as in a program called Farmers to Farmers, which is part of the federal government USAID program. And we went to help train people that are starting a co-op for beekeeping, that want to do organic beekeeping of all things. And it was extremely rewarding personally and professionally to be there and to see that this is a way of increasing people's income that requires very little input, that is cheap, but has tremendous rewards and can change the way they view their trees, their native trees, their native flora, their native insects. So it was extremely rewarding for us to be there. And in a couple of days, we'll be heading down to Costa Rica with one of the queen breeders from Hawaii, who's helping people, in a sense, tame a little bit the Africanized bee that is down in Costa Rica.
We have heard that we've been sort of sourcing queen bees for the mainland for a long time, and that we've been actively involved in that with other beekeepers on the mainland too. Has this spread to the mainland? Are there lessons from the mainland that we can take back here?
Yes, I think there are. People in the mainland are actually concerned about what you said, the large scale, the impact of large scale agriculture, the impact of food production in such scale that is disruptive to the environment. And I think there's a lot of love for the eye now in Hawaii, that people want to regain some of that control and want to feel that what they're doing is not so damaging. So I think there are lessons. I think the U.S. is sometimes split in their, you know, in their goals. But Hawaii, I think, gives a tremendous value to their own land and their own people being able to be self-sufficient. So I'm hoping that will lead us in the right path.
Including to food security, or at least a greater measure of food security.
Yes, bees are incredible as a component to diversify the production of a small farm. If you don't have bees, you have less fruit. If you don't have other pollinators, including flies, you don't have as many mangoes, for example. So we're trying to also tell people about that you need a range of pollinators, that you need a healthy garden. So a healthy garden is healthy people. So we are diversifying by producing vegetables, fruits, nuts. So hopefully that message is getting across. And I, based on, like I said, the visits in the Urban Garden Center, I think it is.
And before we have you go away and have to say goodbye, if there's one plant that you think should be in everybody's garden to be able to say welcome, put out the welcome mat for bees, what would it be?
Basil.
I guess I'm covered then. Okay, thank you so much. Esther Villalobos is a researcher in the Manoa Department of Plant and Environmental Protection Sciences. She focuses on varroa mite treatments, bee or mite bee interactions, colony health assessment, and hygienic behavior.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a look at what's ahead at Bishop Museum. But first, your quiz.
Unihua, Ulehua, Unihau, Ukawa, Uahu, Umulokai, Ulana, Umau, Ukaholabe, Uhavai.
We just talked about a project at UH designed to help local beekeepers care for their hives and also what it's doing to help people every place else. Here's a piece of history, though, about Hawaii's beekeeping. The industry began on the island of Oahu on a Sunday afternoon in 1893. On this particular day, a swarm of bees was caught by the trade winds and blown into the backyard of two brothers living in Honolulu. Their names were Lee and Oswald St. John Gilbert. With virtually no knowledge of honey production, the two brothers began constructing their own hives and researching then cutting-edge beekeeping techniques. After a short time in the industry, the brothers created the Sandwich Island Honey Company. It's considered the first company dedicated to the commercial production of honey and beeswax in Hawaii. And for all his contributions to the industry, Oswald St. John Gilbert earned a distinct nickname and title. For today's backyard quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us what that nickname was. You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know it, and you might just buzz off with a prize.
Aloha, I'm Melina Lilios, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Hawaii's Bishop Museum is home to the largest collection of Hawaiian and Pacific artifacts in the world, with a distinguished history of research contributing to knowledge about the entire Pacific. Has it been a while since you visited Bishop Museum? Well, that's why it's a particular pleasure today to welcome Linda Lee, Sissy Farm, Interim President and Chief Executive Officer. Welcome, Sissy.
Thank you, Noah. I'm so delighted to be here.
So glad to have you here. You've been in the position about a year now. Is that right?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. You came in at a tough moment after a bit of a messy departure by former CEO Blair Collis. He was about 5 years at the helm of the Bishop. And I guess we should start by asking what's happening with the Attorney General's investigation of museum credit card abuse, possible mismanagement of a loan there on his part.
We haven't had any communications from the Attorney General's office in quite some time. And quite frankly, I think we're just moving forward. And that has all been passed. And what we're doing is we're looking at ourselves in many ways. The AG's investigation has helped to strengthen the museum, take a look at itself inwardly, do a self-assessment, and revitalize itself. Mm. And it was extremely heartwarming to see both the internal and external support that the Bishop received from the community as a result of the AG's investigation, mm-hmm. and a positive plus moment for us in many ways to see that we were so well supported. So we're moving forward in a positive direction, and mm-hmm. we're doing wonderful things.
Boy, it has been a tough year, and you are coming forward. I mean, as part of the discussion of Bishop Museum at that time, people were reflecting on the incredible history of the research department there, and Collis had made a move to actually cut research staff and maybe have researchers secure their own funding. What would you say would be the commitment to research in the future there?
There is a huge commitment to research. As part of our business plan, which was adopted by the board in 2016 after Blair Collis's mm-hmm. departure, we made a significant commitment to research, and we got some private funding. It was a donation in order mm-hmm. to help us work on a model for research.
people are looking for how can we do research in this world, you know, non-specific or commercially funded research.
Yeah, that's a very difficult issue that mm-hmm. we face. And we're looking at the standards, the grants, both state grants, federal grants, as well as those from private foundations. But what we've learned is that partnerships are very, very important and possibly the way of the future. For us, we're working together with a number of partners, and we have a couple of researchers who are very active. For instance, our malacologist, Nora Young, is surveying snail, slugs, and semi-slugs around the island and identifying species that most likely carry the parasite that causes rat lung worm disease. And she's actually processing the specimens at the museum's Pacific Center for Molecular Biology to screen them for the parasites. Mm. And we're working with partners from the University of Hawaii, UH Hilo, the Department of Health, and the Department of Agriculture. Mm.
On that, and it's probably a Pacific problem as well.
Very much so.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. In addition, there are other institutions, such as the Smithsonian Institute, that recently had marine geo, and there were scientists from around the world who came and explored Kaneohe Bay, and it was a wonderful partnership with local community groups, mm-hmm. as well as the university. Bishop Museum was there, and we started off with Kupuna and cultural protocols to gain the respect of the area so that everyone move forward in a positive way. So it's not only research, it's the environment as well, the cultural aspects. So we're looking forward to continuing these partnerships.
I've seen the museum make some moves in recent history, having the Science Center, which is so exciting, doing these summer exhibits that are kind of the blockbuster type that make people want to come. I mean, really diversifying and really improving the presentation of your artifacts as well. I'm just wondering how all this can fit into a workable financial picture for the museum. How can you see it stabilizing?
That is the first point in our business plan, is actually looking at stabilization, looking at different ways in order to generate revenue, as well as producing a positive experience, reaching out and partnering. With respect to what's happening at the museum, you do have the Science and Vendor Center, and it's so interesting because the previous speaker in the conversation, we were chatting just out there about uh-huh. how we could potentially partner for an exhibit at the Science Adventure Center and how that would help the children moving forward understanding about honeybees and their importance. But we also reach out and we have other exhibits, such as biomechanics, which is in our Castle Memorial Building, and that runs through September 4th. And that's a way to bring the world to Hawaii. It's a fun, interactive exhibition about the wonders of evolution. And it comes to us from the Field Museum in Chicago. And the centerpiece, and some of you folks may remember this, is the gigantic T-Rex named Sue, who was here in 2000 when we did an exhibit about mm-hmm. dinosaurs.
Sue's back. And this show, I have not seen it yet. Really, it's a must on my list this summer. Certainly, I'm going to take my niece and nephew with this one. Because it's how things work. It's how evolution figured out these amazing tricks to get things done.
Right. They talk about flying, and you get to, in an interactive, sit there and fly. Flap your wings and see how you can move about. There is a giraffe's neck, and it shows how swallowing works and how pumps are used with respect to that. It's very exciting, and it's for all ages. You have the young children as well as many, many adults come through there and are mesmerized.
Okay, that's a good one. You also still have the Homefront exhibit on, the one that DeSoto Brown did about the Pearl Harbor bomb.
We do?
Yeah. That's a terrific one.
It is a terrific exhibit, and we're going to be using that gallery for other exhibits as they are timely as to what's happening within the community.
That's kind of a nice way to use the different parts of the museum, too, I see, because it's kind of a pass-through, but it's where you really have to go anyway, and
right.
It's wonderful to get the information there. You know what? I bet a lot of people have not been to the Kahili Room lately.
Oh, the Kahili Room is a must-see as well. As you walk in the front steps from Hawaiian All, you should turn left because the Kahili
people
Room
miss
talks.
It.
Yeah, most people miss it, but you should turn left. It's got all of the Kahilis. It goes through the monarchy, and it really sets history and the stage for us. And if you turn right, what's there now is Hulia'ano, which is in the Long Gallery. It runs through October, and it explores Hawaiian aesthetic traditions, spotlighting design motifs and visual similarities in the natural world. So it's a real effort to bring nature and culture together to show how, say, this starfish inspired a certain pattern on the tapa. And it also talks about some rarely seen treasures that are really personal to individuals that help to inspire our contemporary artists. And we have partnered with 5 contemporary artists, and they have their works there as well.
Who do you have?
Gosh.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go and see, because I just looking at the designs in the recent Mama Wearable Art Show, so many of the designs on the most contemporary fashions are so related to the design work in Hulia'ano.
It is so much so. One of the artists is Dr. Taporo Tangaro, and he is a cordage artist. He is from the Big Island, Hawaii Island in Hilo, and he was inspired by a particular ki'i who had a cordage garment on it, and he created his own cordage garments from that, as well as various jewelry. We have an artist who does feather work. We have a weaver. It's really a must-see to come and see the inspirations and how it is so relevant to today's contemporary artists.
We'll take that as an invitation. Thank you so much, Sissy. Sissy Farm is the interim president and chief executive officer of Hawaii's Bernice Pauahi Bishop Museum.
Hipster and high-end spots on Oahu are benefiting from a federal immigrant investor program. The only problem is those aren't the areas the program had intended to support. CivilBeat.org reporter Stuart Yurton has today's reality check. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Beth Ann. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, this program that you're spotlighting in the article today is the EB-5 Immigrant Investor Program. What's the criteria for that?
So the program allows foreign nationals to obtain a green card if they invest $1 million in a job-producing business here in the U.S. But they only have to invest $500,000 if they invest in distressed, targeted employment areas.
So then the next question is, what's a distressed area, and how come that could be construed as being Ala Moana, Kaka'ako, or Ko'olina?
So a targeted employment area is supposed to have an unemployment rate of 150% of the national average, or the national unemployment rate. But that's not really how it's working. What happens is the developer creates a map that includes a area with a lot of activity, with very low unemployment, and sort of gerrymanders it out to an area that has very high unemployment. And then when you average it all out, it comes to 150% of the national average, and that area is considered a targeted employment area.
So you're saying there's some sort of jiggery-pokery going on here, little smoke and mirrors, and that allows a developer to do this without any sort of checking on whether that's true or not for that area?
Well, the state does check it, and they make sure, and it does all work, right? So the idea is this is allowed under the law. The state signs off on it using only the criteria that the federal government establishes. So it is checked, and technically it works. but it's not really what the program was intended to do.
Okay, so it sounds like there's a giant loophole here. Is anybody looking at closing this so that perhaps areas like Waianae that could perhaps use this far better might actually get that help?
Yes. So the Department of Homeland Security administers the program. They've actually proposed regulations that would close this loophole. And they say, well, you couldn't really gerrymander these long tracks that might stretch 30 miles across the island from the edge of Waikiki to Waianae or Makua Valley, which is kind of what these districts look like now. So it would make it so that you really have to be around the area where you're developing.
And how soon might we see that loophole actually closed?
The department just finished taking public comments. How long it will take after this, I don't know.
So we're going to just sit and wait and see what happens with this one. But do you know of any other areas that might be targeted?
Well, as you mentioned, we have Kaka'ako, that a couple of sites in Kaka'ako have been designated. We have an area around Ala Moana, behind Walmart, that's been a targeted area. There is this Ko'olina, the entire area resort has been designated as a targeted employment area. There are other sites around the island. There's a place in Mililani that's been targeted.
Okay, that means we're going to have to do some follow-up with you and see how this progresses. For a lot of people, this is going to be somewhat difficult to understand, and yet it's all perfectly legal. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org, today featuring reporter Stuart Yurton. If you drink alcohol, even moderately, you could be putting your brain at risk. A new study by the University of Oxford and the University College London analyzed data on 550 people followed between 1995 and 2015. The study concluded that compared to non-drinkers, moderate consumers were 3 times more likely to develop impaired function in the part of the brain that processes memory and spatial orientation, the hippocampus. So how concerned should you be if you drink, say, 1 or 2 alcoholic beverages per day? Dr. Bill Haining is a physician, John A. Burns School of Medicine professor, and director at large of the American Society of Addiction Medicine. He gave us his take.
The study asks the seminal question of whether there is injury to the brain as a result of moderate intake. We all remember, because it kind of hit us between the eyes several years ago when a study came out purporting that the consumption of 2 glasses of wine per day could improve cardiac health, that in fact it was somehow or another beneficial if you drank a couple glasses of wine each day, but no more than that. Now, note the question that was one of cardiac health was injury to the heart, and there really wasn't any long-term follow-on to discuss any of the other organs or target organ systems, not even liver. As you can imagine, an awful lot of people with industrial industry, not limited to the wine and spirits industry, were happy to sign on to the notion that alcohol had somehow become a health food. This study, if you go back and look at the British Medical Journal study to which the paper actually refers, is done under pretty good control circumstances and with high-quality peer review, and it is intended to look at the longer-term effect of alcohol on the brain and brain function in particular.
You're talking about the Whitehall 2 study.
Yeah, exactly. This is the one that actually just came out about a month or so ago relating to approximately 500 folks, but they were followed over a good long period of time, and what they demonstrated was a fairly dose-related impact of alcohol on brain function over a long period of time. So if you had 1 drink per day, you had little impact. If you had more than 1 drink per day, you had a correspondingly higher impact on memory and to some extent on fluency, on capacity to express language.
Because they look at these individuals over 30 years,
yep.
that kind of, you know, longitudinal data is not something with which you have a great deal of others to compare. This seemed to be rather singular in its approach.
Yes, and as it happens, probably pretty reliable in that context. For the folks who are listening who don't have a particular need to read medical literature on a regular basis, there are really two ways to improve the quality of the study. One is to increase the size of the study population, and the other is to increase the length of time over which you are doing the study. In both cases, as either improves or increases, then the quality of the study is generally held to increase. There are lots of exceptions to that, lots of ways you can sabotage a study by not paying attention to how you've selected the population or the kind of confounding factors.
Could I ask you if you're troubled at all by the fact that when the participants began the study, they were all roughly aged 43, and that's already at a point where people are approaching midlife or that other things may have set in. Should they have looked at people, say, maybe who were 30 or 33?
Yeah, that would have been ideal, and you've identified one of those exceptions in which you can make a selection bias. What tends to balance that to some extent is that these folks were followed over a long enough period of time with controls that in spite of starting it at a midpoint where damage might already have occurred, what you did see was a divergence over time between those who were drinking and those who were not. That divergence is probably what accounts for the conclusions by the authors that alcohol isn't necessarily a health food for your brain.
The fact that we have so many pieces of media that are directly targeting younger drinkers, you know, anybody who is at the age in which you can legally drink, to people who are in their 30s, 40s, it's seen as being, as perhaps it always was, a part of the social fabric and how we entertain ourselves and how we entertain others. Do you think this study is going to begin to modify that at all?
Not by itself. I have a funny feeling that, I mean, there's so much material out there bearing on this subject that is at least mildly contradictory that I don't know that everybody's going to make a sharp left turn and stop drinking alcohol as a result. You know, the objective of any ethical physician should be to put him or herself out of business. So if I take this article in trying to advise my patients, I've got to keep in mind that it's not my job to control somebody's behaviors, but actually just to provide them intelligent warnings or to act as a watchdog relating to their health. I'd have to say that taken in context, what this does is add to existing evidence more than modify it, that alcohol is a brain toxin. I kind of jokingly point out to folks that when Admiral Nelson was killed at the Battle of the Nile, they shipped him home in HMS Victory in a keg of brandy so that his body would not decompose. Alcohol is an excellent preservative, and it is that because it tends to, you know, kill tissue. It tends to kill organisms. Less flippantly, the people who would be most interested in seeing or in targeting the younger population are the ones that you've heard me jokingly refer to as the folks who say drink, but drink responsibly.
I wanted to ask you about that because we hear that message now virtually in every ad. Drink responsibly. So-and-so encourage you to drink responsibly. And now we're looking at the word moderately possibly coming in there too, which would seem to thwart the entire industry that's trying to bring up new drinkers.
National Institutes on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse has a defined scale for what constitutes moderate versus at-risk drinking, and it's available on web. Bluntly, I have never drunk, and I don't know anybody who has, in order to become responsible in my life. Okay, that hasn't been the objective or purpose when I or anybody else drinks alcohol. I don't go and pull down a six-pack and then say, well, that was great. I think I'll go adopt an orphan. We drink in large part because of the behavioral effects, and I don't know that even hearing that there is some impact on brain, that most folks won't say, okay, I'm going to balance the enjoyment that I get from this against what a bunch of rat lab and even human clinical trial scientists are telling me is a progressive impact over time. People have an enormous capacity for ignoring inconvenient evidence.
True. But that evidence keeps mounting. And I wanted to ask you about the evidence that we talk about in the U.S. versus, for example, the evidence that's come from the U.K., including this study. The U.K. government has tightened their guidance on alcohol consumption. They say that there are new pieces of evidence that would link more alcohol to increased risk of cancer. They're also telling people that it's not a good idea to drink more than 14 units per week.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what that 14 units translates to in American terms. They're saying maybe a couple of pints, maybe 4 pints of strong beer, or maybe 5 or so glasses of wine a week. But what does that translate to when we talk to people here? You know, drink a day?
Well, it's 8 grams per unit is what they set as their intake. And for practical purposes, 1 ounce, which we annoyingly continue to use as the measure of volume or weight here, is a little over 28 grams. If I were to translate what they're talking about, 14 grams is a little over half an ounce, and that's in the pure alcohol sense. We're talking about 9 standard U.S. drinks per week. A standard drink is... Interestingly, we've organized it so that a beer and a standard glass of wine or 6-ounce glass of wine and a shot glass of whiskey all contain approximately the same amount of actual ethyl alcohol. So we're talking about a pretty modest amount. It's about 9 standard drinks per week that the Brits are talking about. And our own standard for moderate drinking is only a little bit more than that, about 14.
Just to wrap this up in terms of your takeaway as a physician, as someone who is concerned about toxins and brain function and many of the things that we've already talked about, what's the big takeaway?
Well, as with anything, too much water, too much oxygen, too much of any given medication, excess increases risk. To the degree that it is possible actually to achieve zero alcohol intake, you'll have zero consequences of alcohol intake.
All right, I guess I'll take those odds. Thanks so much, Dr. Bill Haining.
You bet.
Dr. Bill Haining is a physician and professor of psychiatry at the University of Hawaii's John A. Burns School of Medicine. He's also a director at large of the American Society of Addiction Medicine. The moderate alcohol consumption study was published this month in the British Medical Journal, now called the BMJ. And if you're thinking that having only a few drinks per week gets you off the hook, think again. The researchers also found that light drinking offered no protection against hippocampal atrophy.
This morning's backyard quiz focused on a famous man in the history of Hawaii's beekeeping industry. On a Sunday afternoon in 1893, a swarm of bees was caught in a gust of trade winds and blown into the backyard of brothers Lee and Oswald St. John Gilbert. After checking out the swarm, they got interested in bees and beekeeping and especially honey production. They had no prior knowledge of this industry, but the two began constructing their own hives and perfecting some pretty cutting-edge beekeeping techniques. Eventually, they formed the Sandwich Isle Honey Company, which was the first company dedicated to commercial production of honey and beeswax here in our state. For his contributions to the honey industry, Oswald St. John Gilbert was given a name by his contemporaries. For our backyard quiz, we asked if you could tell us what that nickname was. The answer? The Honey King. And that's today's quiz. If you've got one, send it on in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, wishing all students, parents, teachers, and administrators an enjoyable summer, providing opportunities for student summer reading with Achieve Hawaii Home Access. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Jocelyn Sand is director of the Honolulu Botanical Gardens. She's a horticulturist and plant propagator and has worked at all five gardens. That's Ho'omaluhia on the windward side, Liliʻuokalani, Wahiawa, Koko Crater, and Foster Garden in downtown Honolulu. It's great to have you here. Welcome, Jocelyn.
Thank you, Noe. I really appreciate the opportunity.
I wish people could see in their minds as I can the place that you actually work, those terrific parks. Ho'omaluhia there on the windward side, Liliʻuokalani Gardens on Kuakini Street. There's Wahiawa Botanical Gardens. So exciting. Koko Crater and, of course, Foster Garden there on Vineyard. Five botanical gardens that we, members of the citizens of the city, own.
That's right. They're your gardens.
Uh-huh.
And we have five altogether under Honolulu Botanical Gardens. So wherever you live, there's a garden close to you.
Oh.
Yeah, 650 acres, plant collections from around the world, over 5,000 different species, education programs and public hiking, camping, fishing, all kinds of things that you can experience if you just stop by.
We want to get into them. By the way, how's that cannonball tree, our old friend there at Foster? This is a tree, guys, that grows, you know, 80 feet in the air and it's got 5-pound cannonballs coming right out of the trunk.
If I had to pick a favorite tree, that would have to be the one. And I actually was looking at it this morning. It is loaded with flowers. That's the thing about it. It's so generous with its flowers and its crazy cannonball fruits. And I had a great picture I'll share with you.
Okay.
We can put it up on your website where it shows the trickery involved in its flowers, because it has these beautiful flowers that have two kinds of pollen, false and real pollen, and it tricks the bee into going in there and dancing around and pollinating it and making sure that you have all those amazing fruits.
And those bees make a little conga line back on out.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, these are not normal flowers. They're super, almost four-dimensional. They come out like on snakes,
tendrils,
like Medusa,
yes.
like a whole Medusa situation, mm-hmm. all the way up the trunk of this tree. And that's at Foster.
It is at Foster. There's two of them at Foster. There's a few at Ho'o. And they're one of my favorite. And on top of all that, they smell good.
Mm.
They smell like cinnamon and clove to me.
You have got so many treasures going on in these
gardens. We sure do.
We want to find out. We want to stop by and visit. It seems like, as I look around town, palms are in bloom.
They are. And you know, at Foster Garden right now, there is a very amazing palm. It's called the Talipat palm. And it's from India and Sri Lanka. And it has the largest inflorescence, the largest flowering structure in the world. It can spike a flower structure up to 26 feet high. And it just started flowering. It will be going on for a while. Millions of flowers are on this structure, and it takes about 8 months for those flowers to develop into fruits. Those millions of flowers will develop into about 100,000 to 200,000 seeds, and then after that, about 4 months after the seeds develop, the whole palm dies. It's a solitary for those of you who have to imagine it. It's a solitary palm that can be 40, 50, almost 80 feet high. Ours is a little shorter. I'd say it's about 40 or 50. Solitary palm with this huge inflorescence on the top. It's just
25 foot high.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Flower.
It's
okay.
Amazing. And so after that's done, the whole thing passes away. It's monocarpism is what they call it in the plant world. And quite a few plants do it. The silver swords, bamboo, agave.
Tens of thousands of seeds come down.
Tens of thousands. It's a way of the plant hedging its bets and making sure it's going to live on, because predators can't possibly eat all of those. So it's going to survive somehow. So on it goes. We'll have hundreds of seedlings from that.
So that incredible 25-foot flower we can see now at Foster Garden.
You can. It's
decades
up on,
to happen.
It's yes. It takes about 25 years. Mm. Yeah, it can take a little longer, a little less, but everything in Hawaii is on super speed. So,
man, that's a terrific reason to get there to Foster.
And that'll be going on through the summer. You know, it's going to develop its seed and then slowly die off. So, if visitors come by this summer for our twilight concerts or for our
concerts, what a great time to be in the garden.
Oh, I know. It's starting now. Last Thursday was our first one, and it goes through the end of July. Visitors can come on every Thursday from 4:30 to 7, enjoy the garden for free, bring your picnic, enjoy a concert, and you can stroll about and see these things that we're talking about, like the talipot and the cannonball and all kinds of other things, because heliconias are blooming and gingers are blooming, and summer's a really busy time in the garden. So, so come and take advantage of it. We've got great parking and just lounge about and enjoy some music at sunset.
Boy, that's an invitation we'll have to take. What's going on at Cocoa Head? You know, Cocoa Crater.
It's getting so popular.
A terrific loop there.
It is 2 miles, and if you're looking for a easy, accessible family hike. You know, you want to go somewhere hiking. Maybe you have multi-generation in the family. You've got kids. You've got older people. It's a really great hike. It's just enough. It's 2 miles. You can do it in an hour and a half. Right now is perfect because the Plumeria Grove, which is at the front of the garden, has about 80 different cultivars of Plumeria, and they are in full flower. They start off with big, big whites. Some of them, the Marini hybrids, are 3-4 inches across, and it goes through yellows and pinks and then ends up at the beautiful red Plumerias, which I noticed you had some in the vase out there at the studio. And so you can enjoy those flowers, and then you can stroll along and go around the world in an hour and a half. You can go through the Americas. Yeah, we have the cactus and succulents from the Americas. You go down into the back, and our Hawaiian section is huge. We have some great partnerships going on there with DLNR and the Oahu Army Natural Resources Program, and we're putting in new things, rare and endangered things. The Willy Willy trees back there are blooming right now. And then you continue on and you go through Madagascar and Africa, and then dry land palms there. Actually, the Egyptian doom palm is seeding out there right now, the gingerbread palm. And there's hundreds of gingerbread seeds on the doom palm right now.
Okay. Yeah. we may have to see this.
You should. It's some people call it the Dr. Seuss garden because some of the plants are so strange looking. You know, they've adapted to this dry environment and they have big, you know, plump trunks that hold water, and they've got spines, and they've got all
thorns.
Kinds of,
I know.
Yeah, and they're just crazy. It's also a great place to take your camera. You know, if you're a photography buff, because there's just amazing forms and structures out there to capture.
Oh, you've just tantalized us with this description of so many things going on there at the Botanical Gardens this summer.
At Ho'omaloha, we have, again, plants from around the world, all those different collections, Philippine, Melanesia, African, Madagascan, Native Hawaiian. And at that place, you can not only enjoy nature and botanical collections, but we have a lot of recreational offerings over there.
And camping,
so
I understand.
You can camp. You imagine camping in a – we have some of the strangest botanical gardens. We have a garden in a volcano at Cocoa Crater. We have a waterfall in the middle of downtown with Liliuokalani.
Right.
We have a ravine out at Wahiwa, which is like Indiana Jones, like rainforest out there.
Right, in Wahiwa.
In Wahiwa.
Town.
And then you can camp in the base of the Ko'olau Mountains. Imagine anything prettier on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights. You can get a permit online. We're, in case I hadn't mentioned that, we are under City and County of Honolulu. So this is your public gardens to take advantage of. And you go online, and you can get a permit to camp at Ho'omaloha. And they're very nice campgrounds. Everyone has a fire ring, a picnic table, and a dedicated campsite. You could pick which campsite you want to be at. There's bathrooms with showers and operating toilets. And it's not glamping, but it's not roughing it either. And on the Saturday, Sunday, you can get a fishing pole and do catch and release fishing with your kids.
Oh, thank you so much for just catching us up on a few of the recreation options available out there. And we're going to have to look into this more deeply. Jocelyn, you're coming back, and that's a must.
I hope so.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Noe.
Jocelyn Sand is director of the Honolulu Botanical Gardens. Don't forget the annual Midsummer Night's Gleam that turns Foster Garden into a fairyland of luminaries is set for July 15th.
Aloha, I'm Eric Johnson from Honolulu Theater for Youth. If you like today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
There is so much excitement over the return of the Hokulea this weekend. As our colleague Derek Malama is away at a luncheon, we thought we'd have a look at an event that's very much on the radar. Noe, what's the schedule for the big day?
I know, Beth Ann. It's that Hokulea homecoming is there on the horizon, and let me tell you, it's approaching fast. All right, we're looking at Saturday now. And the general time span for Saturday is 7 a.m. until 5:30 p.m. Here's how it rolls. Starting about 7 o'clock in the morning, there are going to be four local voyaging canoes arriving at Magic Island. All right, about 8:30, two canoes from other Pacific voyaging communities, Marshall Islands and Tahiti, will be coming on in to the marina there. About 9 o'clock, we expect Hikianalia, and the Hokulea will come on in just after that to the floating dock at Marker 7. Now, we know that the eight official canoes will be coming in, but there could be dozens, maybe dozens of other watercraft out there, because I'm even hearing that some of the canoe club paddlers are saying, forget the races, we are going to be there.
It's going to get congested, that's for sure.
Yep, it could get a little wild. And then from 1 to 5:30, it's a beautiful homecoming ceremony with music and celebration. Now, remember, there'll be no general parking at Magic Island for that day, of course. Ala Moana Park Drive may be shut down as needed. There's going to be congestion on Ala Moana Boulevard, of course.
So park over at the convention center?
You can do that if you want. You know you're going to pay $10 there. Free parking at McKinley with shuttles running. Enter on Pensacola. And when you go, bring your reusable water bottle. There's going to be coconut-filtered water stations from Kokua Hawaii Foundation. They will be using compostable items only. No one-time-use plastics in the entire celebration. How's that?
That's a huge selling feature, to say nothing of the fact to be there at this incredibly historic moment. Thank you so much for the rundown of the day. That's going to do it for us for this Wednesday. Coming up tomorrow on Town Square, we're going to delve deeper into the statewide issue of beach erosion.
And we'd love to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show, or if you want to hear a segment again, you can find all of it on The Conversation page. You'll also find links to more information about guests and topics, lots of good stuff. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Noe Tanigawa.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you tomorrow for Town Square.